My name is John Holmes, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me down here to share with you this morning. This is indeed a pleasure for me, and a first opportunity for me to speak in an Al-Anon convention. And I am deeply gratitude for that. Somebody said to me as I was walking down here this morning, they said, you look a lot better than you looked like last night, John. She said, y'all, you cleaned up real good. And I said, well, you know that my wife dresses me. And she tells me what to wear. And I listen, too. But what I'd like to do this morning, if I can, is to introduce my dear wife, Mary Emma, and I'd like to ask her to stand, please. She's my greatest supporter. You know, she's heard this story so many times she could tell it herself. But she stays right in there and supports me all the time. And I really appreciate that. You know, my relationship with Al-Anon goes back a long ways. I feel badly because I don't have my, you know how people in AA are. They always want to have that big book close to them. And I left mine home. You know, most of the real high-level speakers, if you ever notice, they have those leather-tooled jobs, you know, that are kind of in various colors, you know. Well, I have a big book that's got a vinyl cover on it. And on that vinyl cover, there was an emblem like this that has AA on it. And that cover for that book was a gift from a member of Al-Anon. Her name is Roseanne. And when she gave it to me, I kind of chuckled, and I never told her the story about this for years. Because, you see, Roseanne was one of those who had a husband who never got sober in AA. And he died drunk. And I said to her, Roseanne, when you gave me this cover, I said, did you realize where that little emblem came from? She said, well, no. She said, I was looking through Jimmy's drawer, her husband, and she said, I found it, and I thought it was just perfect. I said, well, do you know where it came from? She said, no. I said, that came off a decanter bottle of ancient age. So that's what's on the cover of my big book. I'd also like to mention another dear lady, and her name is Winnie Dennis. Not Winnie Eddy. I knew it, Winnie Eddy, but Winnie Dennis. And Winnie Dennis and I have been friends for 41 years, and we're still friends today. She's 87 years old and an active member of Al-Anon. Her husband and I got sober together. He was in his 50s, and I was in my 20s. And we got sober together in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I was one of those crazy AAs that stayed up all kinds of hours. I didn't do a lot of sleeping in those days. And they used to leave a key outside of their house so that I could come in and watch television in the middle of the night. And they'd be, I didn't have a television, and they would be sleeping in the bedroom. And I'd be watching television in their house. They opened their home to me. In 1973, my mother died rather suddenly and rather tragically. And Winnie Dennis stepped in and has filled that slot as my adopted mother from that day until this. That's the kind of lady she is. And I am most grateful for the Al-Anons that I've had in my life. because as I'm about to share with you today, my sobriety has not always been perfect. But you know what? All through those years, Winnie Dennis has always been my friend. And I have shared with her a lot of the problems in my life, and I am extremely grateful for having her in my life today. But I was asked to come down here this morning to share my story with you, and I'm going to try to do that in the best way that I can. You know, I started out in the coal mines in Pennsylvania, northeastern Pennsylvania, in a town called Scranton. And I grew up two blocks from a coal mine. And I didn't realize that we were poor until later in life, because we were all in the same boat. I grew up in a very loving family. And I want to tell you today, you know, I hear a lot of discussion in AA today about the dysfunctional family. Folks, I got to tell you this, and this is the truth. I came from as close to a functional family as anybody in AA ever was. You know, I had a wonderful mother and father. I had three great brothers. Is that we were raised in a church and with great value systems. My mother and father did not drink. My brothers drank a bit, but not like John did. And you know that I grew up in this family, and in my early years in this family, I was a third son. I have two older brothers and one younger brother. And growing up in this family, I had a pretty good relationship with other people and even with God. You know, I didn't have a lot of problems with this church. As I felt pretty good. I felt that I had a little bit of a relationship with this God that they talked about, and I felt pretty secure. And then I got to be about 12 years of age, and things started to change. And I began to feel somewhat different. But that's not unusual. A lot of male kids at 12 years of age begin to feel a little different. That's puberty, and that's normal. But I began to feel really different. And I could not put my finger on it. And I had a great feeling come over me that I was less than. And I thought for a while it was because I was growing up in these neighborhoods with these Russians and Czechoslovakians and Hungarians, and all these 12-year-old kids, you know, were 150 pounds when they were 12 years old, you know, and I was this skinny little drink of water. And I realized that it was not really that. And, you know, I kind of fumbled along and found girls and thought they were really neat. Found out for the first time that they weren't just soft boys. And I liked them, too. I liked them. And, you know, I was pretty much in touch with what was going on in the family. I had a wonderful, wonderful relationship with my father. I had a real tough relationship with my mother. My mother was a very intelligent and beautiful lady. And you know, I as a Catholic kid, I really had some real tough times as far as my mother was concerned for this reason. There was a side of John that loved and worshipped and admired my mother. And there was a side of me that just hated her. And you know, if you're a Catholic boy growing up in that era, you're not supposed to feel that way about your mother. But I did. But I couldn't tell anybody. And you know, she would say black and I would say white. And you know what she told me when I was in my teens? She said, "You are by far the brightest of my children, but you're not going to go to college because you won't conform." And I didn't say this to her, but inside I said, "To hell with you." And I went my merry way. I was 15 years old, folks. I had my first drink. Now, I realized by today's modern standards that I waited a long time in life to have that drink. But it was the best I could do. And I want you to know that I also understand that it's not the same with everybody. But folks, I remember who was there. I remember what we drank. I remember whose car we were in. I can remember the feeling that happened. And it was magnificent. You know, all of a sudden I became all the things that were lacking in my life. I instantly became that person. I became all the things that I dreamed about wanting to be. Instantly I became that way. And you know, that little bottle was passed around between those four people and that little Mercury, 38 Mercury, and I was wondering what they were doing drinking my booze. And the feeling was powerful, folks. And I realize that it's not the same for everybody, but it was for me. And what I'm about to say to you today may not be agreed by everyone. But I believe it's for me. I believe that I was an alcoholic that very first drink. And the reason that I say that is because it was so powerful in my life. And it was so memorable in my life. And what I did is I pursued that feeling with everything I had. And I want to tell you what took place that night. I got drunk. I got sick. And I blacked out. First time out of the box. I've talked to people in AA who said I drank for 20 years and never had a blackout. I had a blackout the first night. What does that indicate to you? This kid should never, ever drink booze. But I did. I pursued it. And you know, here was this bright, articulate kid in school. And I was a bright kid in school. Things came easy to me. Too easy. Which made me lazy. That's what my mother recognized. And I chose a whole different set of friends in 1 year in school. I chose a set of friends who drank like I did, and there weren't many of them, folks, but there were a few. There were six people in my group that drank like I did. There's two of us still alive. The other four are dead. The other person, Ron, Mary Emma knows him, is sober in AA, but that's another story. And I'm so grateful for that today. I'm grateful for every drink that I ever took in order to be able to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous when it did. Because I would have been a lost soul. And you know, one of the things that happened is that I struggled to get out of high school. Here was this bright kid going to a college prep school, and I struggled to get out of high school. And later, when I was sober, I went back to my father after my mother died, and I said, "Dad, did you know what was going on with me?" He said, "Oh, yes." He said, "We all knew what was going on with you." And I said, "How did you know?" He said, "Well, let me show you." And that dear father of mine went upstairs and went into a closet, pulled down my report cards, and he laid them out on the kitchen table. And here was this bright, well-disciplined young man up until the age of 15. And you know what happened, folks? Those grades just fell right off the table. And I went my merry way. And this was my great decision. Here was my great decision that I was going to have in graduation from high school. All of the rest of my friends in this college prep school were going off to college. And I knew that would not be for me. You know, I look back on it, and I always thought what a poor decision I made at that time. And I want you to know, folks, as I look back on it now, it was a magnificent decision that I made at that time. And it must have been God-inspired. Because when the rest of these people went off to college, I had two choices. I could go to work in the shoe factory for $35 a week, or I could go in the service. The year was 1952. And I made my choice, and I ended up in a place in a sister state over here, a place called Parris Island, South Carolina. I was in boot camp in the United States Marine Corps. And it was a very good decision, and I did not know it at the time. Because what it was going to do is going to change the direction of my life. And I went through boot camp, and I came home and destroyed about 3 automobiles in the family after returning from boot camp. And I had a 10-day leave, and I was about to go to Camp Pendleton for some advanced training in California. Now, here's this young kid that grew up in the coal mines of Pennsylvania. And the next place that he traveled to outside that state was the Parris Island, South Carolina. Not exactly 2 garden spots of the world. And they finally poured me on this airplane, and I flew into Burbank, California. Folks, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. You know, at Southern California in 1952 was a paradise. It was just beautiful. I can remember getting on that Greyhound bus, and we stopped in Santa Ana and went across that long prairie. And El Toro Air Base was there, and we wound down after the prairie down into a valley, and it was all planted with lemon trees. And we wound down into a little town called San Juan Capistrano. I'd read about that in the books, you know, the swallows returning to San Juan Capistrano. I thought, my God, it's paradise. You know, this is just paradise. And, you know, we left there, and we went out onto, and I got a look at the Pacific Ocean. This beautiful blue Pacific Ocean. And I thought, by God, if I ever get back from where I'm going to, I'm going to live in Southern California with all the rest of these folks. And, you know, I didn't know where I was going to go. I went to cold weather training in a place called Pico Meadows in Nevada. And before long, I got shipped overseas. Spent the first winter in Korea. Did not really appreciate that very much at all. Got shipped out of there and ended up in the 3rd Marine Division that was just forming in Japan at that time. And I had come in somehow or another through this period of time, I had become a buck sergeant. That's still a mystery to me. Somehow or another, I think I got it mixed up along the way. As I was a drunk in the making, but I want you to know, folks, the reason that I didn't do more is I didn't have enough money and I didn't have enough opportunity. That was the only reason. But I was going to have some opportunity that was going to come up, and I was going to have a little bit of money. And I was reported into the 3rd Marine Division, and they said to me, Sergeant Holmes, what would you like to do? I had never had anybody in the Marine Corps ever ask me what I would like to do. It was kind of like an employment agency, and I said, well, what do you have? And they said, well, we have an opening in a weapons company. And I cleared my throat a little bit, and I said, what else do you have? They said, we're looking for a staff car driver for a high-ranking officer. I said, sounds very interesting. Sergeant Holmes became Major Lepretti's driver. This is a whole new adventure for Sergeant Holmes and also for Major Lepretti. To some of you in this audience today, this is not going to make any sense. If you've been in the military, you know how much sense it makes. Major Lepretti was a Navy Cross winner. That's the second highest honor in the United States, right next to the Congressional Medal of Honor. He had received that as an enlisted man on Guadalcanal. He later came back and went to school, became an officer in the Marine Corps, and came back into the regular ranks and rose to major. And he was the Marine Corps' Marine. He was the tremendous example. And he had Sergeant Holmes as his driver. And the only way I could, I could go into stories about this forever, about Major Lopretti and I, but this really describes it to a T. On Friday night, that staff car, that Chevy, would be leaving the base. Sergeant Holmes would be driving, and the major would be sitting in the back. Sunday evening, that staff car would come back through the gate. Major Lopretti would be driving. And you already know what happened to Sergeant Holmes. And that was kind of the sum total of my time. And I was getting kind of short time in the Marine Corps, and I was due to go back to the United States. And my plan was that I was going to go back to the United States. I was going to get out of the Marine Corps. I was going to stay in Southern California. I was going to make a fortune. And already, my drinking was totally out of control. It had never, ever changed from that first time. It went like this. John would get drunk. John would black out. John would get in trouble. Never changed. You know, they say, well, how does the alcoholic think? Well, you know, if you're alcoholic and you're sitting out there now and I tell you this little story, it will make perfect sense to you. When I would get paid that little bit of pay that you got when you were a sergeant, I'd sit on that bunk of mine, and I would make little piles of money. It was supposed to take me through to next payday. It never worked that way. You know, that in two piles, it would be just gone. And the reason for it is because it would be drunk away. And you know that I didn't realize what was happening. I did not realize. But you see, I didn't have enough money to get into kind of trouble that I was about to get into my life. When I came back to the United States, I only had a short time to do in the Marine Corps, and I was stationed once again at Camp Pendleton. And I was going to stay in Southern California. So you know what I did? This great alcoholic thinking. I went out shopping for a wife. I mean, I had no business even considering the idea about a wife. But you know what I was looking for? I was looking for a keeper. Somebody who would kind of keep a place that I would come into once in a while. Because you know that all I wanted to do was to dress in fancy clothes and drive a fancy car and have a job that paid me a lot of money and have somebody else raise that family. And you know something, folks? I found one. And you know what I did? I got married to this gal. And I was going to take this gal to places that she had never planned on going to. Now what she had on her hands is a raging alcoholic. But I want to tell you something about the raging alcoholic, because I think that this is very important. I had a tremendous capacity for booze. I could drink for days at a time, and a lot of people would not know that I was drunk. I could be talking to people in a blackout and them not know that I was drunk. And that's the way I operate. And I did that for a couple of years. I say a couple of years because that's as hazy as I can remember it as a couple of years. I could drink around the clock, come in and take a shower and go to work. I had tremendous energy. I used to say that I drank for energy. And you know, during this period of time, two children were born in this family. A gorgeous little blondie and little boy. And you know what? I wasn't even around. I was the epitome of the selfish, self-centered alcoholic. The only thing that I was interested in was looking good. I did not have the capacity to care about another human being. All I was interested in was me. And you know, we had the little house in suburban Skid Row, and things were kind of falling apart. The in-laws bought the house. They were paying the payments. I never paid for anything. I had jobs and jobs and jobs and jobs. And finally, I got a job with the Los Angeles Times. And folks, it was a good job. Best job I had since I'd been in the Marine Corps. And what I did was I continued to drink. You know, a newspaper is a place that a lot of people drink. I mean, they have a lot of alcoholics in newspapers. And you know, as long as you don't really kind of act up too bad, sometimes you can last for years in these newspapers. Not me. You know, it was during this time that two things happened, which I think were turning points. The first one was, and the alcoholics here today will know about this one, they were going to have a family meeting. Any alcoholics ever been in a family meeting? The meeting is about you. And I'm hungover, and my in-laws are there, and this poor little wife is sitting there, these two little kids are sitting there, and they're talking to John about his drinking. And I can't wait until he shuts up, because my head is about this big, and I hurt all over. And I remember the words. The words were, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to lose this family. You're going to lose your job. You're going to be in worse health than you are now. And everything is going to be gone. And when I thought they were finished, I stood up and I said, you can all go to hell. Because I'm going to do in my life what I want to do. And you're going to have to figure out what you can do. And that's exactly what I did. A couple of changes were going to come about. You know, I was no longer drinking that top shelf booze because I couldn't. And I was no longer able to afford the kind of things that I afforded before, which were the fancy suits and the fancy cars. You know, I was going downhill in appearance too. You know, I didn't have that fancy car anymore, and I didn't have that fancy clothes. And I took up with a couple of young men in Southern California at that time by the name of Ernest and Julio Gallo. And I was going to do my very best to support these people and make sure they stayed in business. And the reason that I did is because it wouldn't let me get too high and it wouldn't let me get too low. And it was in the right price category for me. And you know, the job was beginning to just slide, and I had been warned and warned and warned and warned about my drinking. And I lived about 35 miles from downtown Los Angeles to report to the Los Angeles Times main building. Monday morning, 8 o'clock, that sales meeting took place. God, folks, you don't know how bad that was trying to make that meeting. You know, I hurt so bad. I was hungover so bad. I would crawl into that meeting and try to make it. Finally, they said to me, you know what, John? We realize that you've got some stuff going on in your life you're going to have to straighten out. But what you're going to have to do until then is when you finish up on the territory at the end of the day, you're going to have to start reporting into the office at 5 o'clock. Oh. How do you drink that sweet wine all day long in that hot heat in Southern California and report into the newspaper at the end of the day? Nobody else had to do that. And you know the reason I had to do that? If you happen to be an Irish lad and you drink that sweet wine, you look like a beacon in the night. You know, you get that flushed red face and that beezer that's just looks like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you know. And I had eyes that were just kind of like slits. And they were bloodshot all the time. Never cleared up. And that's the kind of shape I was in when they finally said to me, you know what, John? We don't need you anymore. And handed me my paycheck and sent me on my way. And I was about to go to back to this little suburban Skid Row house. And as I drove back up in my little drunk car, and I'll tell you about that in a minute, The moving van was in the driveway. Hallelujah. They were loading up the little sticks of furniture from the alcoholic's house. Any of you are familiar with the furniture that comes out of an alcoholic's house? It's always borrowed from someone else or bought at a swap meet someplace. You know, there wasn't much to it, folks. And those few little pieces of furniture they were loading on this moving van, this poor gal standing there with these two little kids, and she had had it. And finally she said, you know, I'm going back home to Mom and Dad. I said, bye-bye. You know what? I was glad to be rid of her. And I didn't have much thought about those kids, because I was never much of a father. And they left, and I had that little junk car that I had. I was trying to figure out what to do. Southern California, you don't go back and live in that house, especially when you don't pay for them. They come and board up that house immediately, and you're out on the street. And folks, I didn't have any friends to go spend a couple of weeks with. I couldn't call Charlie and go over there and say, Charlie, you know, I had some hard time. I didn't have any friends, folks. And the reason I didn't have any friends is that if you let me get close to you and you had something that I wanted, I would take it. I didn't have any thoughts about that. So I'm trying to decide what to do, and I'm in a state of despair. And I said, I know what I'll do. I'll go park this car in an orange grove down here off Valley Boulevard, and I'll take up housekeeping in that car with these two other fellas, Ernest and Julio. And that's where I went. Now, I had a 1957 Renault Dauphine. Now, they call them Renaults now. In those days, they called them Renaults. And there's a few people old enough to remember what they look like. You know, a Renault was kind of like a little box. And I had a four-door, which had split seats in the front and a bench in the back. And if you're 6'1" trying to sleep in a Renault, that is really a chore. It takes a lot of wine to sleep in that car. And anyhow, I don't know how long I was there. I would like to tell you that I could remember that, but that is all just one wine hazy fog. I don't know how long I was there. But I was sinking further and further and further and further into that deep dark hole that we have to fall into before we come to AA. I rolled out of that car one morning, and I was on my knees, throwing up blood. Been doing that for a couple of years. Thought that was just kind of normal. Everybody had drank a little too much, threw up blood. But that was just part of the price. I really was. What I was concerned about, what was going on inside my head and inside my soul. See, folks, I had gone as far as I could go. There was nothing left. There was no fight left in me. Now, I had no relationship with God. He and I parted company at age 15 with that first drink. It is my opinion that from the time we take our first drink of alcohol, that we start to spiritually separate ourselves from any kind of higher power with each drink that we take. And I was out here. And I cried out that morning in total despair. Please, God, help me. And I got an answer that was immediate, like that. And it was as if that tape was running full speed in my head and all of a sudden stopped, and there was a message on it. And the message was, call Alcoholics Anonymous. And to the best of my ability, I had never read, heard, or seen anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not even know it existed. You can call that experience anything that you wish. But I wish to call it John's spiritual awakening. Maybe John's spiritual experience. Because I had no question in my mind. I had no fight left. I got in that car and I drove into Los Angeles and I called information. And instead of me giving me the number of AA Central Office, they connected me. Must have heard the despair in my voice. And a gal answered, her name was Sybil. And she answered the phone. And she talked to me for a while, and she realized what trouble I was in, and she said, "Can you get to this address on Southwestern Avenue in Los Angeles?" I said, "Yeah, I can get there." She said, "If you can get to this address, this is the Southwest Delano Club, and there'll be somebody waiting there to talk to you when you get there." I said, "Okay." Got in my little drunk car, drove down to the front of this building. Not very fancy, folks. Little storefront down there. It's located right in the middle of Watts, a black district on Southwestern Avenue. I looked at the storefront, and you know what, folks? This little storefront of the Southwest Delano Club was right in the middle of the territory I was fired from at the Los Angeles Times. Never knew it was there until I needed it. And I walked up to the door to open the door. There was a little guy inside who opened the door from the inside. And his name was Joe Motes. He's dead a long time. And he opened the door and he gave me this big smile and he reached out his hand to me. He said, "I don't remember." And this is what he told me. I asked him two questions. He said that I asked him, "How do I become a member? And how much are the dues?" He said, "Sonny," he said, "as far as becoming a member," he said, "if you step across that threshold," he said, you're a member of, you can become a member. He said, "as far as the dues are concerned, it's apparent that you've already paid yours." And you know, I walked across that threshold into the Southwest Delano Club. And the date was April the 9th of 1959. I was 24 years old. And I could not go another step. And I came to you people a broken, sick, alcoholic. You know, if you're a wino and they call you an alcoholic, I mean, that's like two steps up. And it was in the days in Alcoholics Anonymous when there weren't many young people. No, I should rephrase that. There weren't any young people. And I was determined to stay. Because, folks, I wanted to get sober worse than anything else in the world. I didn't have much going for me, but I really did not want to return to that deep, dark pit that I had come out of. Also, I have to tell you about Joe Motes. About this high, little hex-colored glasses, thinning hair, meanest son of a bitch in AA. Perfect for me. An old Chevrolet, smelled like used wine. It had a seniority system in that Chevrolet. If you were the new guy on the block, you sat on the hump in the back seat. And as you stayed sober and he kicked other people out, he was a temporary sponsor, 30 days, that's it. As you moved up in the car, you know, you kind of moved up to a better seat. Finally, I had moved up to the middle of the front seat. Because he always took six people. And I turned to him one night and I said to him, "Joe, when am I going to get a chance to talk in AA? He looked at me with those little beady eyes and he said, "What the hell would you have of value to anybody in AA?" And he was absolutely right. He was absolutely right. And you know, finally after 30 days in the program, what he did is he walked over to this guy at the meeting one night and he said, "This is your sponsor." Now I realized, folks, that we don't do that anymore. I didn't know you could say no. I didn't know you could say, "Well, maybe we can't communicate." I just kind of looked at my shoes when he said to me, where are you living? Now, I'm 30 days sober, right? That big deal, 30 days sober. I'm still living in my car. Nobody said to me, you know, well, we think we'll get you a treatment center. There wasn't any, folks. I think maybe we'll take you someplace and pay for a motel. No deal. First 30 days in Alcoholics Anonymous in those days in Los Angeles, you know what they did with newcomers? It was a little roll along the wall. They said, any newcomers? Yeah. Didn't want to know your name. Didn't want you to open your mouth. Weren't interested in anything you had to say. Sometimes I think maybe it might not be a bad idea. And you know something? It was good for me because I was just kind of sucking it in. My new sponsor was a guy by the name of Howdy. He's also dead. And I said to him, where are you living, John? I said, I'm living in my car. He said, uh-uh, no, no more. He said, you're coming home with me. Whew. I don't know how many of us today could do that. Here's a perfect stranger. And he takes me home with him to live in his basement. Folks, I had a bed, I had a commode, I had a sink, and I had a metal shower. And you know about those metal showers? Tough to turn around in that without beating yourself to death. You know? And I'll tell you what, it was good. It beat the hell out of that 1957 Renault Dauphine. And I had a radio. Not a television. I had a radio. And I could listen to music. And I was grateful to be there. And you know, people have asked me, they said, John, when you got sober in AA, did they ever talk to you about 90 and 90? I said, no. They never, ever said 90 and 90. We just went to a meeting every day. I didn't have much else to do, folks. Of course, I took care of his pool, and I became his gardener. He had the best lawn and the cleanest pool. And, you know, if you're 24 years old and you start to get sober, what happens is you start to look good on the outside pretty fast. And your health starts to return because my sponsor's wife is fixing all these meals and I'm eating everything that isn't nailed down. And life is good. And you know what my sponsor says to me? He said, you're going to have to go back to Los Angeles Times and you're going to have to make amends to those people. I said, wait a minute. Now, I've heard those steps. I said, that amends step is way down the line. He said, I don't care what you think. This is what you're going to do. I was living in his house. I said, okay. He said, this is what I want you to tell him. And he went through what he wanted me to tell him. And you know what? We had to go through that three times. Because I kept changing it, you know. He said, no, that's not what I said. And so finally I had my little script, and I went down to the Los Angeles Times. And what I was going to do is I was going to make amends to them, because what I wanted to do is I wanted to clean up that area, because I had really screwed that up. And I got down there, and it was a non-alcoholic. Guy's name is Paul Mahoney, and I will never forget that. And I told him exactly what my sponsor said, and no more, not another word. He said, John, he said, how would you like your job back? You know, that's not what I came there looking for, folks. I came there to make amends, to clean up my side of the street. And finally he said to me, don't think we're doing you any favors. He said, we tried about six other people in that territory, and you had it so screwed up, nobody could make a living. And you know, I went back to work for the Los Angeles Times. And I went back to work for them sober. And you know, folks, I'm a good worker sober. And you know, I want to share one thing, and I know that I'm kind of running this long, but a couple things I need to share with you, and that is this. If you're 24 years old and you start to get sober, there's also some dangerous things that can happen to you. And that is that you start looking good on the outside, and people start patting you on the back and tell you about what a wonderful job you've done. And there's some danger in that too. Because you know what happened, folks? you might begin to believe that. Because you know where my great sickness was? It was on the inside. That's where my great sickness was. And you could not see in there. And finally what happened is I had to move out of my sponsor's house. And I'd like to tell you tonight, you know, that this guy got back with this gal, that this wife and those kids, and everything was just wonderful. There was too much damage done. That would not happen. I created too much chaos in that family. She could not take that. And we parted permanently. That gal I spoke to you about before, Winnie Dennis, she went with me to court. My Al-Anon buddy went with me to court. And there's a couple things I want to tell you, and that is this. I haven't done a lot of really great things since I've been sober. But one thing I have done, without fail, is I have supported my two kids every month exactly the way it was supposed to. And my sponsor is more responsible for that than I am, because he insisted on that. He said that those children are the innocent bystanders of alcoholism, and they're not going to have to suffer any more than they already have. You're going to support them. I said, if I pay that child support, I won't have any way to live. He said, tough shit. He said, you'll pay that child support, and you'll figure out how to live on the rest of it. And you know what? I went back to work, folks, and I never had it so good. You talk about somebody that was busy. I worked a full-time job. I went back to school and college. I sold real estate on Sundays, and life was good, and I went to a lot of AA meetings. And I mean that I had it good. And you know, I continued to work for this newspaper for the next 5 years. And finally, through a set of circumstances, I left that newspaper business, and I went to work for a company in Wisconsin, and I became their West Coast Regional Sales Manager. That was my job. Folks, it was the best job that I ever had in my entire life. I had no boss. And my territory was the 11 western states and Hawaii. Single. And they paid all the expenses. You know, sober, I went to meetings every place in the West and Hawaii. And every place I went to meetings. And you know, folks, I went to meetings in the beginning. I went to meetings in the middle of my sobriety. And my wife will tell you that I go to a lot of meetings today. And the reason that I do is because I need to. I need to stay close to what's happening in AA. I'm an active member in good standing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I close today, though, I want to tell you something. Sometimes I listen to speakers in AA, and it's like they get sober, and they win the lottery, and they live forever on a cloud someplace up here close to God. Not this guy. I've made a lot of mistakes in my sobriety. I have paid very heavy prices for those. You know, after 2 years in this job, I decided that I was going to marry a not-too-sober lady with three children. And I was going to move them from Southern California because now I was going to become a national sales manager of this company after 2 years. You think maybe ego was a little bit at work there? Also, I never told my sponsor that I was going to marry her because I knew what he would say. Because what he would have told me is what happened when we got married and moved to Wisconsin. And I worked for a company that was riddled with drunks. Chairman of the board on down, they were all drunks. I became a designated driver before the term was ever coined. And they all thought that it was wonderful that I was sober, and they were all drunk. And folks, the company I worked for made a lot of money. And they made sure that their key people made a lot of money. And I made a lot of money. I made a lot of money. And I was very interested in that because I thought that that would fix all of the problems in my life. You know what was going on, folks? Is that little family was getting sicker
that I had taken on, and my business career was getting better. But the price that family paid was terrible. My contract was up in 1971, and I moved that little family to the state of Georgia and started a business with a partner. 1971 was a great time to start a business. 1973 and 1974 was a time that you could hope that you could survive in business. And we did. And you know, things were going along well. The family was getting worse. My relationship with this lady was getting worse. And in 1978, she and I decided that what we needed to do is we needed to part company. Now, you know, if there's people sitting out there today that have gotten a divorce, you will understand what I'm saying. If you have not, there's no way that you can understand. A lot of damage was done in this divorce. There was a lot of angerness and bitterness in this divorce. In 1978, in January, we separated. In June of that year, 6 months later, my partner and I, who started this business together, committed suicide. And I was staggered. I was absolutely staggered. And one of the things that happened is that I really had to take a long, hard look at myself during this period of time. And I had to take the responsibility for the wreckage of my sobriety. I had made a lot of bad choices. I had made a lot of wrong decisions. And the exposure of this divorce is when I got exposed for what I really was. And it was not pleasant. And you know, I called my brother, my younger brother, who was a psychologist, and I said to him, George, I said, it seems like I have had some really poor choices with the women that I've gotten tangled up with. And it was a pause on the phone, and he said to me, but you were the one that was making the choices. You see, I had to take the responsibility for that. I was a guy who was sober a long time, still sick. And I think that this is common in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things that I decided is that things were going to change in my life. If I had to stay single the rest of my life, that's fine with me. But what I was going to do is I was going to change. I took a month out of my life and I went back to Southern California. And what I did is I completed that cleanup job in my life that I started so many years before and never finished. And I came back to Atlanta and redoubled my efforts in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was happy doing so. I continued to run this business. And I said that what I was going to do is I was going to dedicate my life to this program. And I was going to try the very best that I could to help other people in this program. Because I finally felt as if that I had something to share. And along about this time, God sends this little blonde-haired lady into my life. And she was a breath of sunshine in my life. And you know, the first time that we went out together, we had just a wonderful time. And I thought, you know, she's such a great person. She sure as hell is not going to have anything to do with me. And you know, we went to dinner and we went to movies and we just had a great time together and we laughed and just had a wonderful time. My father was still alive and my niece got married. And I had come back from overseas and she had flown up to Pennsylvania and she met this little father of mine. And I have to tell you in this meeting what took place. You know, here's this little guy that I love dearly meeting the love of my life for the first time. My dad was a hugger before we ever existed. And he grabbed a hold of this little blonde and he hugged her and he whispered into her ear. He said, "My kingdom for a blonde." He was 90 years old. And I was so thrilled about that. And you know, folks, Mary Emma would have gotten married in 6 months. I was scared to death. Not of Mary Emma. I was afraid of me and what I would bring to this relationship. You know, God has been so good to me. I don't have words to explain it. The God of my childhood is not the God that I know today. The God that I know today is the God that you introduced me to in Alcoholics Anonymous. This little lady and I went together for 2.5 years. We got married in 1982. And it has been a wonderful experience from that time until this. She is a great wife and a great supporter. And I am eternally grateful to you in this program for allowing me to get better. Because you see, even in my sickness, in my sobriety, you didn't judge me too harshly. You let me get well in this program, and you let me change. And today, the guy standing before you is a different guy than came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's because you taught me how to live. And I am forever grateful for that. I love each and every one of you, and God bless you.